This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Hawk, Dr. Lyle, how are you both doing this evening?
Doing well.
I'm amused that the alphabetical shtick is still going strong.
It's excellent. Great.
All right. Well, it's been a couple of weeks since we've heard from both of you, and we missed you, and we are now on the format of doing it every other week. How'd the break go, you guys?
Good. I heard Jen's had some naturalistic adventures in Hawaii. Tell us a story.
Hawaii is a very adventurous place, and so I'm here alone now because Doug's back on the mainland. So I'm here with Michael, and I are just hanging out, and we've been interacting with the flora and fauna. And I had my Hawaiian rite of passage today. I got bitten by a centipede, which is like notorious. Like Hawaii is notorious for not having too many evil venomous creatures, but centipedes are a little bit of an exception. So if you've never had the pleasure there, you've seen well. Doug, I know you've seen them around here, right? Yes, they're terrifying.
Yeah.
Paleolithic armored terrible things.
Yeah.
and so we've just been sort of trying to capture them when we can, and they scuttle away most of the time. But I today was hanging out inside and went to give my dog Melly a little hug on the couch and felt this like sharp sting and stood up, and centipede fell out of my skirt. It had like crawled in there while I was on the couch with the dog, bitten me because it was so pissed off to find itself, you know, in a strange territory.
Yeah.
And then like fluttered away and went under the couch. And so we went and grabbed the vacuum and vacuumed it up, which it survived its journey into the vacuum canister with no problem.
Yeah.
And being the bleeding heart plant-based people that we are, we spared the life of the centipede.
Never. I would have never spared it.
oh my God. It's like they move so fast.
Yeah.
Like it's almost harder to you know, not spare it. So just took the vacuum outside and dumped it far away from the house.
Yeah.
Pretty exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if it was that big, where's the mama?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we can't figure out how they're getting in because they're huge. And so, his disturbing hypothesis is that they're just born in the house. Mm. There's a whole family that just lives in the house and reproduces. Mm.
Lovely.
And, we find their little, because they eat bugs mostly. Yeah. So we find these cockroach corpses usually overnight. So it's a whole food chain of horrifying insects. I'm like looking and trying to figure out, you know, what were the best ways to deal with centipedes. And so the recommendation is usually
fasting.
Get some chickens in the yard, because the chickens really love them. So I need, if anyone's got a hookup for like rescue Maui chickens, let me know, because I would love to rescue some and have them peck around and feast on our centipede family.
Yeah.
You know, I'll bet if you go to the local farmer's market, you might find a chicken or two that doesn't want to be where they are.
There are a lot of chickens around, but they all seem pretty well established in their little chicken pods. So I don't want to disturb any little chicken families.
Well,
all right. Well,
but
thank
you. It's a nasty sting. It's big, big welt. And it's so much for paradise.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, Dr. Hawk, thank you for that story and for giving us a little break from just the you know, the
Dr. Lyle's desire to just go straight to the questions and my desire to...
I know, I'm trying to lighten things up with, you know, little
tales
of horror from the islands.
Time to get on with it. What do we got?
Oh, back into masculine energy, I see. Very task-oriented.
That's all right.
Much for chit-chat.
We're probably going to get 3 emails telling us that we should go back to the way we did it, and then 3 emails that say we should keep doing it this way. So that'll
right.
be fine.
There we go.
All good.
All right. A few months ago, we decided not to go live anymore, and we changed our live call-in phone number to a voicemail that people can call in and leave a voicemail. And so we've gotten a number of voicemails that we really appreciate. We just haven't had time to put them on into the show, partly for technical reasons, but we figured it out. And so we have one of our listeners who gave us a really, really fun question. Really interesting question I'd like to hear the answer to. So Dr. Lyle, Dr. Hawk, we're going to hit play and then the listeners will listen to the question and then we'll get your take on it.
Okay.
Okay, sounds good.
Hi, big fan of the show. Just have a question or two here. I thought I'd leave a voicemail so it's easier. So I've noticed that Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk, instead of trying to directly calm someone down about something that they're anxious about, what you tend to do is get them good information so that they can become informed and remove distortions themselves rather than to try to just face the problem and try to be okay with it or use some sort of bogus calming technique. This shows that, you know, you take your own theory to heart and that the only real thing you can change that can change your thoughts or feelings is information we can acquire and process. So my question is, are there situations where you actually avoid using the down arrow technique with people to attempt to reach a position of power by coming to terms with the worst case scenario? Is that sometimes not the right move? Like when the worst case scenario is actually pretty bad, like they're worrying about a potential life sentence in prison or a looming possible bad cancer prognosis or whatever. You know, the imagined potential suffering of others they'll leave behind after they die early, I don't know. But is that when the only thing left becomes full on grieving and acceptance? Seems like even the grief over death causes us to come out in that position of power. I know that personally when I stopped believing in an afterlife, for example, I had to grieve that, but it doesn't really bother me anymore. I can imagine it being basically the same process no matter what. You just resolve those open loops by confronting the problem so that you can feel confident in what could happen and what you're going to do or not do about it. So do you sometimes choose to not quite go there with people who are facing the real possibility of those tougher worst case scenarios, unless it becomes a more sure thing? Thanks.
That's a great question.
Really thoughtful question.
Very thoughtful, and obviously a very bright listener who has integrated our way of thinking about things. So I think I'll respond to this. Jen, feel free to chime in, but I would say that I can't recall a time when I was not willing to use down arrow. There's times when you wouldn't because it may not be being called for. So I can remember having a session with a man who had a terminal diagnosis, and we were talking through sort of how he was going to spend the next, you know, 6 months or however much time he had. So we weren't down arrowing, because down arrow is really a technique that you are utilizing for anxiety when people clearly are ruminating about the worst case scenario. In this case, he wasn't ruminating about the worst case scenario. It had already happened. And we were then simply having a session talking through about how to most intelligently use the time he had left. So that's what we were dealing with at that time. But if someone was facing a possible big cancer diagnosis, and they might be spinning on what that would all mean and look like. Probably what I would do, I probably wouldn't grind my way down through the down arrow, but it would certainly be part of the dialogue that I would be having with them. And so what I would be signaling is I would be signaling essentially that I had processed the down arrow. And I would say things like, well, it may turn out that this is it's the worst case scenario. And it may turn out that we have a terminal diagnosis. That's a possibility. Okay. But you know, there's nothing for us to be doing between now and then when we find that out. So what we're gonna do is we're going to proceed with, you know, essentially by learning all we can about the situation that's in front of us and make the best decisions that we can. So I would, what I do is I am willing to name the worst case scenario and to talk about it basically and fearlessly. And the reason that I'm doing that is because they are afraid of it, or they very well may be afraid of it, or they may be afraid of the social interaction where that's discussed. And so they may want to talk about it, but they don't want to overwhelm the other person because they've got enough empathy that they don't want to put the other person in this terrible position of having to reassure them or just be overwhelmed by what it is that they're facing. So as a clinician, what I do is I signal to them that I'm not overwhelmed by whatever it is that they're facing. And so, and the way that I get to that position of power is, I mean, I get there, I mean, obviously I get there genetically by a great deal of natural stability in my personality. But I also get there, I mean, but I didn't have that much stability in those situations when I was 25 and I was a grad student, okay? But now that I'm 60, I do have that kind of stability, and I've had it for a long time. And part of it came from cycling through down arrows with people, you know, 1,000 times for all the trials and tribulations of human life, that every permutation that you could think of that causes people a lot of anxiety, you can use down arrow and basically come to the watch the position of power reemerge. And so as a result of that, that is what I feel. I don't like to be facing possibly very, very negative outcomes. Nobody does. But at the same time, I'm not going to hide from them or stick my head in the sand clinically about it. And so if it's indicated and the person needs to process or is spinning, I very well might use the down arrow technique, because we may need to get them to move through what would their decisions be if it turned out that it was the worst case scenario. You know, where would their kids go? You know, what would the finances be? And they may be spending a lot of mental energy cycling through those worst case scenarios, but not getting to completion because they aren't actually talking them out or thinking them through carefully, because their mind is so busy hopping from one perspective to the next under the tremendous uncertainties that are involved. So in answer to the question, I can't think of a time where I would say to myself, no, don't use down arrow under situation X. It's much more of an issue of where the client is at with their particular situation, where they are at that moment in time, what seems to be the thing that's troubling them most. And if it's a bunch of open loops and anxiety and spinning, et cetera, I would never hesitate to calmly and unapologetically walk through down arrow, explain to them why it is that I was going to do that, and be willing to face what is probably at most a 10 or 15 minute, you know, emotional acute event, probably 5 minutes, while it is that we sort of unapologetically look at that worst case and then start talking about matter-of-factly about, well, what would we do then? Okay. And so, yeah, I actually think that that's probably one of the greatest strengths there is to down arrow, is that as a clinician, you realize we're not magic people. We're not here to sprinkle fairy dust on it, and we're not trying to make you feel better for 3 minutes or 15 minutes. What we're here to do is we are here to essentially, clean out the closet of the confusion and anxiety that's inside there, and give you a basically a better informed shift in perspective that you can walk out of the office or end the session and be in better shape now to deal with whatever it is you're confronting.
Wonderful. Now, for listeners who may not have heard what the down arrow technique is, I encourage you to listen to some of the previous episodes where Dr. Lyle goes over it. But there's also a really good resource that Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk have created called the Living Wisdom Library. So you can go ahead and visit that at esteemdynamics.com, join, become a member. And there's a 3.5-hour 24 video module that explains, general psychology, personality, and esteem processes. And I'm sure there'll be a down arrow technique talk sometime in the future, someday. Anyway, so Dr. Hawk, what say you?
Yeah, no, I think he's covered everything that I would want to say. I think that we are very unusual because we're not, this is not typical psychology. This is not psychodynamic, tell me about your childhood, and I'm just here to be an audience for complaining for some amount of time, which a lot of therapy is. And so we are very solutions-oriented by definition of what we're doing. And most of the people who are seeking consults with us are receptive to Down Arrow because they are trying to solve a problem. They're trying to manage their anxiety around something that seems unmanageable. They're trying to get to a solution to improve their life and to fix some kind of dilemma. That said, there have been times when I've talked to somebody who is not interested in that. They are just interested in spinning, and they're trying to avoid the problem. They're not ready to confront it. And that usually is pretty clear, and they're signaling it really clearly to me that they don't want to confront it. They're not interested in it. The down arrowing it is really just going to create more stress for them because it's not something that they really want to think about. That's not why they book the consult. So in those kinds of cases, I'll let them kind of just process, and we'll talk about it, and I'll walk through that avoidance with them. I'll be their companion in their avoidance, rather than stress them out by pushing them into a situation that they're not ready to confront. But when people are sort of aware that there is something out there that is scary and that they want to solve, then it's almost always a good thing to do.
There you go. Excellent.
Wonderful. Dr. Hawk, thank you.
Yeah. All good. That's a good idea for, that's a good idea for a little, a video. I just wrote that down to add to the Living Wisdom Library. It would be, half an hour on Down Arrow, just explaining the logic. I hadn't thought about that, but that this question brings that up, and I think we'll do that one of these days.
Good. Yeah, fantastic. I think so often again, what happens with people who come to us is that they've already gotten halfway there. They're good. We get a lot of very conscientious people who are they just kind of have that innate worst case scenario chip in them already, but they haven't thought through all of the parameters and all of the possibilities. And that's what we're very helpful for, because you can't always see the whole context that you're swimming in. And so we're able to point that out to somebody who is, has the personality and the willingness to do that kind of work, but that's not always everybody.
Mm-hmm. All good.
Well, speaking of willingness to do work, here we have a question about education in the United States. So, dear doctors, I'd love to hear both of your takes on this question. Imagine that you are magically made emperor of the K-12 education system in the U.S. Essentially, you have complete authoritarian control over the entire system and can expect 100% compliance on your vision and your mandates. So how would you design the system, and how does the Big Five and evolutionary psychology affect this design?
Well, I'll take a swipe at this, and then we'll let Jen find where I was too ham-handed.
Let that emperor flag fly.
I have not given this any thought at all, or virtually no thought at all. The evidence, as I understand it, is going to basically explain that the educational process is not going to, it's not going to be influencing anybody's intelligence. That's for sure. It's more a babysitting service. I mean, this is how it is that you have mothers that can go to work and parents that can go to work and know that their kids are safe and halfway productively engaged. And let's face it, most of what school is about, it's a social process where, you know, people flirt and they test, you know, they learn about where it is that they stand with respect to a bunch of dimensions. So it's growing up is what it is. And so I don't take the educational system seriously at all. No, there's exactly zero evidence that anything that you do in the educational system makes any difference at all. So if you're, it doesn't matter if you send your kids to the fanciest school that has, you know, I don't know, I think it's called the Steiner method or something like that. There's just some ludicrous concepts. Rudolf Steiner. I've had people spending, you know, $30,000 a year sending their kids to private schools from the time they're 6 or 7 years old, as if this was going to make some difference. It will make absolutely zero difference other than drain your bank account. So if you make me czar, okay, then what it is that we would do? Well, the only thing that I see that a governmental intervention should be looking at would really be your people at the very bottom of the curve. That's who the educational system should be incredibly sensitive to and be looking to help. So remember, even in the worst economies in the United States, 90%+ of people have been employed. So real typical in the United States these days is, you know, it's a bad economy when you have 6% unemployment, for God's sakes. It's a good economy when it's 4 to 5. Okay, so this is, so basically 19 out of 20 people that are looking for work, you know, can find it. So we're not worried particularly about the upper 90% of the distribution. We should be very worried, if we're a government, about the bottom 10% of the distribution. So to have the bottom 10% of the distribution, to be basically to carry the blank slate, everybody who's born equal concept into the educational system is a total fiasco, and it's a grand waste of resources, and it does a serious, probably a very major injustice to the people that need to help the most. So if I was czar, I would be looking to determine what could be done for those people at the bottom, and it's not getting them up in reading, writing, and arithmetic so that they pass some score to do that, because they're never going to be able to do that well, and even if they do it well, it doesn't do them any good. So what could be useful would be actual skills that would be valuable in the marketplace, something where they could learn procedures to do jobs that, you know, that an unskilled person can't do and that people with more native ability don't want to do. And so that's what I would be looking for. And so I don't know that there is such training that could be done, i.e. trade school. I don't know that, like in principle, a government in theory could be nimble enough to respond to changing marketplace demands fairly reasonably if specific skills that were useful in the marketplace could be identified. But what's going on now is you know, a tragedy, basically, that these young people are being basically frog marched through 12 years of failure, as they have an inability to process the sort of verbal intellectual information that's required to pass school. So they can't do it. They never will do it. It's not part of their capacity. And even if you could fake their way through it, it doesn't do them any good. What could do them some good is learning about how to, you know, be an assistant plumber. That could be super useful. Okay. What could be useful is learning to be an assistant about replacing transmissions. That could be super useful. So if you make me czar, obviously those were two typically male things. I'm not thinking from the female end of things, but you know, there would be other, there would be things like that. And I don't know, I'm not even going to say it because I'll get into trouble. But the bottom line is that there's probably 30 or 40 or 15 or 50 sorts of skills out there for which it would raise the person from an unskilled laborer who is really not worth the minimum wage, or they would be hired. Okay. And so we change that individual to an individual who's worth, instead of being worth $5 an hour because of their low abilities in an environment where the minimum wage is 10 and therefore they've been legislated out of a job. Instead, if we can educate them so that we've got years in there that they could develop really quite a lot of skill, and if they could develop such skill, they could be worth $11 an hour as a skilled person or semi-skilled person, and now they are employable. And so, and they may be, you know, just give them a great deal more flexibility and opportunity in their life. So that's what I would do. And like I said, the details of it, I'm not exactly sure how you do it. I would do it scientifically and experimentally to get the best possible effect. So I'd be smart about, you know, I would get some smart people to help me figure out how to accomplish that. But that would definitely be the direction that I would go.
Fabulous. Unfortunately, we lost Dr. Hawk, so we just wanted to get your answer, your audio. So let me connect Dr. Hawk again.
Okay. Okay, all good.
Yeah.
That's probably in protest is probably why she... All right.
Here we go.
Go ahead. Let's go ahead and hook her up.
Hello.
All right. Here we go. Okay. You good?
I'm good. Okay. Is Doug good?
Okay. Doug, you still there?
Yes. I'm still here.
Okay. So, Dr. Hawk, do you want to respond to the stuff you didn't hear about what Dr. Lyle said? But if I understand
did you guys even notice I'd gotten kicked off the call? Well,
if I can summarize just to yes. see if I understood it right, Dr. Lyle, your point, which it makes perfect sense to me, but you know I'm just a lowly chiropractor, so
yeah.
For me, what you were saying essentially is that we focus on the very bottom of the belt distributions of the bell curves of the people who have the lowest ability and therefore are not served memorizing a whole bunch of facts and figures that everybody else is memorizing because they'll never be able to put it to use. And instead to put them into, is to develop skills like maybe trade school or something like that. And if there was a government system that was nimble enough to adapt quickly to the market and the necessity for those skills to essentially change with the times, depending on which skills are needed. And that would put those people in a better position to compete for resources when they have those skills.
Yeah, that's a basic idea. Don't try to fix the IQ. Try to put more ability inside the person through rehearsal and education. That's what I would do.
So, Dr. Hawk, are you still on?
Yeah, I'm still on. Yeah, the connection is okay. Yeah, the connection's okay with Doug, although I'm still having a lot of trouble making your words out. It's very choppy. Mm-hmm. So your summary of what Doug said was also difficult to hear. But I think I've got the gist of it, which is that, yeah, it totally makes sense to me. I think there is a little... place for there to be some policy around that, because I think if you leave that entirely to the free market, you're eliminating an important safety net where those skills might not otherwise be acquired.
Unfortunately, the rest of Dr. Hawk's answer got cut off due to technical difficulties, but we're going to pick up where we left off and start with the next question as we get reconnected.
All right. Let's see what else we have, Nathan.
All right. Our next question. Dear doctors, I want to make sure I understand beating your genes. If people are told no, punished, held back, negative reinforcement over and over again, it will affect the genes. Is this a true statement?
The genes, like epigenetically? Is that what I think that's what they're asking about here. Is that how you take that?
Yeah, I think that's what they're trying to say.
Yeah. There's sort of this idea that is out there in the world, and it comes, it has a couple of different forms, but the general idea is that, your environmental experiences, including how you're disciplined as a child, or sort of patterns of certain types of abuse in your early life, that they can affect the expression of your genes, or that they can change the brain, or there's all these different ways that people talk about this and think about this, including there's this vast literature that I had to contend with when I was writing my dissertation about historical trauma and epigenetic and ancestral trauma, and how, you know, these sort of suggestive studies that populations that live through a famine, that the eggs inside the female that then the is your grandmother, somehow that this trauma that she goes through is passed on for many, many, many generations, including your own. So your current food issues in this lifetime are because your grandmother lived through a famine. So there's this kind of whole idea, and it even goes as deep as this questioner seems to be suggesting, that, you know, even if you're over-disciplined as a child, that that's going to somehow affect your genetic expression later in life. And this is just, there's just really no evidence for that. So the quick answer to epigenetics questions like this is that, this is not a true statement, to just summarily answer your question.
This is just Jen being more academical than I am, and, you know, just slicker with her words. It's just BS, people. This is directly contradicted by massive amounts of evidence that indicate that the environment early on in life is actually more responsible for the variance in things that you see in behavior. And then it becomes less and less and less and less part of the variance. So, for example, and let me explain how this would work. So early in life, let's suppose a couple of people, a kid with 100 IQ genetically, is born into a family, or is not born into a family, but is raised by a family with a couple of parents that have 130 IQs. And so those parents are hovering all over this kid, giving him flashcards to try to get his vocabulary up, doing half their homework, and essentially pushing the daylights out of everything. And it looks like, you know what? They're about a 80th percentile student. And that's what it looks like. It looks like, wow, we're having a big environmental effect. And it is. Okay, so that person's twin brother being raised by people at 100 IQ is right dead in the middle of the bell curve at the 50th percentile, right where he belongs in by the sixth grade. But our person that was raised by these superstar people, that person's at the 70th or 80th percentile, except we have to check out what happens by their freshman year of college. Freshman year of college, those two twins are right dead on 100 IQ, exactly what we would expect out of them in terms of grades and functioning. So in other words, the genes become vastly more determinative of where it is that we see people's life histories go as you watch them over longer periods of time. Anybody that's ever watched an NBA game can understand this well. One team goes up by 7 points at the end of the first quarter. Is the other team worried? I think not, okay? You'd rather be ahead 7 than below 7, but the truth is that if you look, for example, of who scores first in an NBA game, that has exactly zero predictive ability to determine who's going to win that game. And if there's the score is within 10 points at the end of the first quarter, it also is going to remain basically zero. Okay, so if you have a 9-point lead at the end of the first quarter, there's almost no advantage. You're almost not more likely to win that game than lose it. So the point of the matter is that the genes, as you let the game go on, you see the evidence of the genes starting to overwhelm the short-term variances that you see from, you know, unstable characteristics of environmental opportunity or distress. So the notion. This whole BS story is all about a twisted attempt to keep alive the concept of the blank slate. Your child is not limited because epigenetics. They can turn into Einstein after all. Doesn't matter that they're flunking seventh grade, you know, pre-algebra. Don't worry about it. There's epigenetics is there to save you. Okay? No, it's not. That isn't how it works. So it's going to turn out that the genes will tell the basically tell the story better and better as time goes on. The notion that the whole concept of epigenetics, by the way, is a you know, fairly interesting concept in biology. It's not an illegitimate concept. The concept of epigenetics is that there's a reaction range to how the genes determine what happens to what's known as the phenotype. So your skin, the genes inside your skin will make your skin darker or lighter dependent upon how much sun exposure you get. That's at what epigenetics is. It's the reaction range of what the genes do to the environmental cues that are out there. Okay, epigenetics is not about how the genes change as a result of the environment. Okay, the gene action changes. In other words, the little protein codes that they do different. So you can get a tan and then you lose your tan. Okay, so if you're traumatized, what happens is you go through a set of appropriate reactions to that trauma in order to basically, it's encoding new knowledge about the threats of the environment. And then your functioning will return to baseline. You haven't permanently changed the deep genetic structure that it's determining the neurobiology of your nervous system. Not even close, people. Not even remotely close. I don't know that. Actually, we can tell by the long-term stability of personality and the increasing determination of genes as you follow through the environment, follow through the lifespan, that we know that nothing of the kind that is being hypothesized by people whose writings and thoughts gave rise to this question, none of that is legitimate.
Wonderful, Dr. Lau. Thank you. Dr. Hawk, what say you?
Yeah, I mean, that was taking the little seed of the epigenetics question and spinning it out into, I mean, this is, we are always dealing with this set of topics. I just published an excerpt on the website and on medium.com that sort of really, really gets deep into, you know, what do these environmental effects actually look like when we really break them down? So what Doug was just talking about the genes having a bigger role to play as you go through your life, I think that is not a very intuitive notion for a lot of people to really understand what that means. And that's what we're talking about when we talk about heritability. So heritability is talking about how the role that your genetic profile is playing as you get out of your childhood environment. You actually, as Doug is saying, you become more of who you genetically are as you age. So the events early of your early life have less and less and less of an effect. So he used the example of the hovering parents, you know, doing your homework for you. Another one that comes up a lot is your weight and your physical size and your health. If you're growing up, if you're a child that's been adopted into a home with incredibly healthy food, and you know they're fitness freaks and they go biking every weekend and all of these things, that is going to be, that child is more likely to have a healthy weight than its twin who's being raised in a family that, you know, orders pizza every day and never leaves the house to do anything and is living a very standard American diet lifestyle. But if you take both of those people, both of those twins, you get them out of that home environment and you let them make their own choices in the college dining hall, they converge, their genes start to actually demonstrate who it is that they are actually encoded to be by that genetic profile. And that becomes more and more true as people age. So most traits become, you know, they start off at 40% heritable when you're looking at, you know, people who are age 10, and then by age 80, it's up to 70 or 80% of the variance is explained by the genetics. So this comes up all the time because people are looking for so many other explanations of why they're having trouble solving the key problems in their life. And they are looking back at these environmental experiences, these childhood problems, these very intuitive places that they're going to look for where things went wrong. And so we are always trying to steer people people around and to actually empower them with the real information, which is that your genes are really, really driving the show here, and that these childhood events, these early, you know, how you were disciplined, whether you had baby Einstein, all of these things really do not amount to anything. What kind of school you go to, apropos of the last question, really that stuff does not amount to much in the long haul.
Mm-hmm. Now, do we know, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you, Dr. Hawk, for your answer. Do you know if, how long, say, a traumatic event may alter someone's behavior? Is that kind of, I know it's individual, but, you know, obviously it's not 50 years, but do we know yet? Does, I mean, is my question too broad? I mean,
no, let me explain. So the issue is that previous experiences will alter the behavior as long as they have legitimate they're the best data to inform the current cost benefit analysis that the person is running. Okay, so if you let's suppose that you were beat up by the bully next door 3 days ago, and you're a 10-year-old kid. Now, the bully next door still lives next door, and you saw that, you know, his mother chewed him out and spanked him, but he didn't cry, and when he was walking in, he just gave you a smirk, okay? And your dad told you, hey, well, you're just going to have to deal with tough people like that, so, you know, be, you know, toughen up, buck up. Now, where you are now is your assessment that you've still got a big problem is still there. Now, let's fast forward now. 12 years from now, you're not 10 anymore, now you're 22. Is that having an influence on you? No, it's not. It's not influencing anything. So you already know at that by that point that there are big, strong, stupid, you know, disagreeable, dangerous people in the world. So you are not highly sensitized as a result of the bully next door. You're just running a CB in all situations. So the notion, the psychodynamic notion is, oh, well, I now have a new boss, and it really reminds me of the guy next door because they both have red hair and they were both kind of overweight. So as a result, I feel like all traumatized. No, nothing of the kind takes place. Your boss, if he's a friendly, jovial guy and gives you good feedback, it doesn't matter if he looks even superficially remotely like that guy. In fact, it probably doesn't matter if it is that guy. Okay? The circumstances have changed. The new CB about the entire situation is now different. So your question, Nathan, is how long could an environmental effect last? The answer is, well, it could be for a lifetime. It could be, like, for example, Jen's now been bit by a centipede. So
that's so funny. I used that example in a session today. I was just answering this question in a session, and I used the centipede example because it's like, yeah, now I have this strong correlation where it's like, under these circumstances, this couch, as far as I know, is full of centipedes. And so if I within some amount of time, and we took the couch apart and we investigated it and there were no centipedes, but still, like if I go to hug Melly again and I have a similar experience, that could be a very rare, weird event that would happen again sequentially so soon after this last time. But let's say that happens tonight. If that happens tonight, I'm done with that couch forever, even though that would be an incorrect assumption to make because it would be a freakishly, probabilistically freakish event for that to happen twice in a row. But it could happen twice in a row. And I am a correlation machine. And if it happened again, my correlation would go as close to 100 as it's going to get. And I'd be like, no way, I am not taking that risk again. And I would basically, my openness would close down around getting any more information to take a different track of inferring what that environment had in store for me. And if that was the case, then yes, that trauma would permanently affect me for life. But as long as I remain open to overwriting the information that I have with subsequent experiences that have a different outcome, then I can have a different experience and make a different inference and, you know, not expect centipedes to bite me all the time.
Correct. Yes. So that is exactly how this is going to work. It's a beautiful explanation. So in environmental quote trauma or opportunity, good things, bad things, doesn't make any difference. If it stands as the most important data point, good or bad, in a data set associated with environmental contingencies, then it will influence behavior all the way to the grave. Okay, most of the time that doesn't happen. So most of the time we don't have some bizarre outlying situation that is so great or so devastating that it dominates the person's equipment. Okay, just not how it works. So the person is smart enough, like I've had people that, for example, have lost loved ones in auto accidents where the person's been in the car. Okay, they didn't get rid of the car. They didn't stop driving. They didn't even become paranoid when they came near the place where the accident happened before. Now, for a period of time, any or all of those things might, you know, there might be an influence for a short period of time. But the brain is not meant to be a trauma psycho. That's not what it's meant to be. The brain is meant to be a cost-benefit analytic engine. And so, therefore, it's constantly working on attempting to get to the truth. Now, the truth is complicated enough that once in a while, in the situation that Jen just mentioned, that if she was bit twice on that couch in a short length of time, then essentially what you can do is you can manufacture a completely adaptive superstition. Okay, so at that point, it's like, hey, listen, I don't know what the story is with this couch, but it's out of here. Okay, actually, probably more intelligent would be, we're leaving this house. that actually, but the thing is that because of the stimulus characteristics are inferred that, hey, it's something about the couch seems to be the issue, then the nervous system would probably be more worried about that than the general environment. So that's the nervous system attempting to hone in on the critical variables and attempting to sign CBs as accurately as possible. So that's actually a great question, Nathan, and it helps us try to explain the entire structure of psychology, the whole nature of motivation is and the nature of how it is that, quote, people change, can change, and cannot change. So our big thing that we attempt to explain is that your personality cannot change, but your cost-benefit analysis about a given set of environmental contingencies can change dramatically with new information. In fact, that's the only way that your reactions are going to change. So that whether, as Jen says, you think of yourself as a potted plant trying to move to the most benign circumstances, that or also we are a thought differently, we're a cat that is now instructed because it has surveyed the landscape. It came into the landscape very afraid. But now it actually knows all the hiding places and it's mapped it out in its mind. It now has a better understanding of the environment and now feels much safer and much more in control of the trauma, you know, the trauma threats that are out there because it now knows what the structure of the environment is better. The cat's personality did not change. Its understanding of the environment changed and with it, its thoughts, feeling, and behavior.
Wow. Dr. Lyle. Dr. Hawk, thank you so much. That answered my question. It goes into our next question, which is pretty much what you guys already talked about. So we can skip
the,
that
the
one.
Question that we're going to answer next week.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So that, I think we did some good work this week. Really appreciate Dr. Yeah. Hawk's intake, Dr. Hawk's take on this, including the story of the centipede. Dr. Hawk, we wish you all the best with this couch. Hopefully you guys cleaned it all out. And Dr. Lyle, we really appreciate it as well. And we'll look forward to talking to you guys in a couple of weeks.
Fantastic, Nathan. Thank you. Great good. Work despite all of our technical challenges. Good hearing from you, Jen.
Yeah, you too. Come back to the island full of centipedes soon.
Yes, on my way soon.
All right.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, you guys.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.